Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As we celebrate National Travel and Tourism Week, we also take a look at the struggles of a tourism-based economy. Jennifer Sherman is Associate Professor of Sociology at Washington State University. Her research looks at the ways in which job loss, poverty, and economic strain affect families, particularly in rural U.S. communities. She's author of the book, Those Who Work, Those Who Don't, Poverty, Morality, and Family in Rural America. She joins us now on the line from Washington. Jennifer Sherman, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And we should tell folks you were a speaker at in South Dakota not too long ago, and the weather sort of made you do that via Skype, that conversation.
So
yeah, you have
I
a South Dakota connection.
Never
yeah. quite made it physically, but you showed up in a way that you could. And I was looking at your research, and I just find it so fascinating, and I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your interest in this area and in this community that you've profiled and done so much research on.
Yeah, well, so I first visited the place that I call Paradise Valley as a tourist myself. I was there on a rock climbing trip, and it struck me as so similar to the community I had profiled from my previous book, and yet so different. And that was really where my interest came from, was it felt like, oh, the history is really similar here, right? You've got a logging community that's really lost its logging industry, which has declined throughout the Northwest. But this place looked so different. It was so vibrant. There was so much going on. And I was really curious to know what are the impacts of that set of changes. So it looks great from the perspective of a tourist. But I did think about, you know, my former loggers from my previous community. And I thought, well, what would their lives be like in a place like this? Is there room for them still as this community changes so much? And, just a whole new set of foci and a whole new set of services.
Right. And so you had just dozens of conversations, in-depth conversations with some of these people. What did you find out about their willingness and their sort of desire to have their stories told, to be heard?
I think in general, people are really open to telling their stories if you're willing to listen.
Yeah.
I've done hundreds of interviews over the course of my career now, and I did 84 in Paradise Valley with people on sort of, you know, newcomers and people who were from the community originally or had lived there a long time. And I found on both sides that people really wanted to share their stories and be heard and be understood. It's I think, an experience most of us don't get very often, to really talk about our own lives in a lot of depth and be self-reflective that way.
Yeah. What sort of things did you find about how, the community had changed and who was really sort of left behind as the tourism industry took root?
Yeah, and this was the really interesting story here was I went in knowing that from the macro level, when you look at communities like Paradise Valley, that they look on paper like they're doing really well, right? There's a lot of economic growth, there's job growth, there's, you know, by all sorts of economic indicators, these are places that are doing quite well. But if you get down on the ground for those people who've been there for a generation or more, it's a really different story. And for a lot of people that had lived in Paradise Valley a long time, what they were experiencing was that it's just getting really hard to survive there. There are jobs, but they're not the same as the logging and the sawmill, the more manufacturing type jobs that had been there, which paid a sort of living wage for usually a man. Now a lot of the jobs are in the service sector, and there's still quite a bit of construction and carpentry, but it's a lot harder for the locals to get those manual labor jobs. And those service sector jobs are seasonal, they are often part-time, they are just jobs that don't pay a living wage, and so it's become really hard for people to support their families. And as the community has experienced a lot of in-migration, housing prices have risen so rapidly that people are getting priced out of their own housing market. They're even getting priced out sometimes of their own homes, where they own the home, but they can't afford the taxes anymore. So it's really, really a struggle for the people that have been there a long time, and they often don't have as much education as the people that are coming in. They don't have what we call soft skills, right? That said, it's manners, presentation of self, ability to communicate in a certain way that the newcomers have. And so they're really struggling in the labor market, and they're struggling to make ends meet and support families.
So this becomes an economic divide in the community, but it's also a social and maybe even a political divide at some point.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's a lot of what the research looked at, was not just the, you know, the economic divide, which is pretty massive, but although, you know, nobody's making a lot of money in this place. This is not a place where you go to get rich, and all those newcomers as well have taken pay cuts to be there, but they just have more personal resources of, you know, various kinds to fall back on. But what's really interesting is the degree to which these two groups who live in this very small community really don't mix, and they don't really know each other very well. They don't interact on a daily basis, and a lot of what I look at is the ways in which this does sort of fuel the types of ideological divides that we're seeing, you know, in this community, but in America more generally, right? Just we're not sharing enough experiences or interacting enough with each other to fully grasp one another's perspectives in a way that fosters empathy, community, or really a sense of commonality. So we're instead kind of looking at each other as strangers across a divide, and maybe, you know, in competition for resources, but certainly not sharing the same end goals.
In your research, and as you listened to people's stories, did you find themes of, you know, where you kind of thought, well, if this had been handled differently, maybe we would have had a different outcome? What sort of themes did you sort of see that contributed to this divide again and again?
I think there's a lot of ways in which you could create a space for community to occur, and that was, I think, a lot of the advice I gave to people on the ground who really were trying to deal with this was, you know, really thinking about, okay, how could you include those people that are being left out? So as newcomers come in and build all sorts of new social structures and social opportunities for themselves, they tend to just look at the people that are not included as not having an interest. And I think that's an oversimplistic view, that, you know, frequently they don't know how to begin to be included. And so there are ways, I think, to ensure that those people who have fewer resources are brought into the conversation, are brought to the table, or are, you know, are just taken into account. And so I did counsel a lot of different community organizations about how to, you know, how to do that. And just even little simple ways, if you're throwing some sort of festival, you know, make sure people that are lower income have a way to get there and can be included in that conversation. If you're throwing a fundraiser, think about, you know, if you're if you're within a community, making right. sure all members of the community are represented there. And if they don't have the resources to be there, then, you know, figure out how to make sure they are. And then as far as addressing some of the community's problems, that was also one of the most important things, was thinking about not just, okay, there's a lack of childcare, let's make sure there's more childcare, but let's make sure those people who are working the lowest wage jobs can also afford that childcare, even if it means coming up with subsidies for some of them. And just really thinking across the divide and not just about the most privileged people, because they do tend to have the loudest voices.
Right. You write about moral capital. What is that? How do you define that?
Yeah. So moral capital builds on the work of a sociologist named Pierre Bourdieu, who looked at capitals that could be traded that weren't simply economic. So there's there's economic capital, that's just money. But then there's also these symbolic forms of capital, which are really resources that are non-economic but can be traded either for each other or for economic capital in different ways. So we talk about, as sociologist, cultural capital, that's sort of norms and manners and you know, ability to maybe speak about art or music. We talk about social capital as your network ties and the resources you share within them. Moral capital was something that I really uncovered in my first set of rural field work, where what I found was in this community that where they didn't really have a lot of access to other types of symbolic or real capital. They didn't have a lot of money, and they were pretty homogenous, so there weren't really differences in things like cultural capital. What I found was that being able to really show or manifest your work ethics and your family values, really your moral values and your moral worth to the community in different ways, became its own form of tradable capital. So if you could really show in some way that you had strong work ethics or that you had strong family values, that was rewarded in the labor market. It was rewarded through social network ties. There were different ways in which that came back to you, and you could actually trade on that sense of yourself as moral for other types of opportunities within the community.
As we look at, tourism season beginning, and it's such an economic, engine for many communities. Mm-hmm. Are there ways that you would suggest people sort of take a broader view of the impact of a tourism-based economy?
Yeah, it's a tough question, right? Because I think in a lot of ways, there's no one individual who can fix social structural problems, right? It's not, yeah, and I don't mean to, in my work, be blaming any individuals for what's gone on in these types of communities. I think it is a question of our priorities more as an economy, as a capitalist system, and thinking about how do we reward the different types of work that people do. So we have traditionally had very low wages for a lot of the jobs that are part of a tourism economy. These have often been feminized jobs. They're jobs that are done mostly by women. And I think going way back through history, those have been jobs that are not paid as well. And so a lot of, I think, the problems that a tourist economy engenders have to do with just the fact that it's, you know, once you've transitioned from something more like manufacturing towards something like tourism, you have a lot of work that isn't full-time, that is very poorly paid, that isn't very secure, and that these are the kinds of issues that we need to grapple with more than the question of should I or shouldn't I visit a place. You know, I think there's lots of reasons why a tourism economy can be helpful, but it is also a question of, you know, how will the people that are doing those jobs survive, particularly as these places become more in demand and housing prices rise and stuff like that.
Right. What surprised you about this research? What continues to surprise you about it?
I think one of the things that surprised me, honestly, was the grace with which people accepted the changes that their community had been through. I think as an outsider and knowing a lot of different rural communities, and I actually grew up spending my own summers in a tourism-focused rural community in the summertime, I remember a lot of anger. I remember feeling resentment. And I was really impressed with this community to the degree to which they understood that they were economically dependent on this form of development, and they did not resent it. They didn't, you know, even for the most part, I would say they didn't address their frustration with individuals. They really seem to understand that it's not an individual's problem. They had frustrations with the way things were turning out, but I think by and large, I was really impressed by the degree to which everybody sort of understood this is our best option and we have to make it work, even though it comes with some real downsides for us. So I think they were really very thoughtful and accepting about the challenges that they faced, and I guess didn't expect that.
Yeah. Jennifer Sherman is Associate Professor of Sociology at Washington State University. Her book, Those Who Work, Those Who Don't, Poverty, Morality, and Family in Rural America. Dr. Sherman, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.